What's up, guys? Welcome to the Hypertrophy Cast. My name is Luis Frielingsdorf. I'm the podcast host, and today we are joined by Chris Barakat, who hasn't been on the podcast before. It's his first time, so yeah, really glad to have you on here today to discuss some hypertrophy related topics. Chris, do you mind giving us a little introduction? Maybe tell the listeners a little bit about your educational background and your evolution as an athlete.
Yeah, for sure, man. Thanks for having me on, Lewis. I really appreciate it. So just to give you guys a little bit about me, I started competing as a teenager in 2011. I was 19 years old, my first competition. And from there, I really fell in love with the sport of bodybuilding. I didn't even know natural bodybuilding was a competitive endeavor until 2010. So after that first competition season, I decided to really pursue educational programs that would further my understanding for bodybuilding. So I got my bachelor's degree from Stony Brook University in athletic training, which is basically a blend between sports rehab, physical therapy, and like first responder. So I kind of have that background at first. I was going to go to school to be a physical therapist to grad school. And I shifted directions and got my master's in exercise and nutritional sciences. Again, just to really follow that bodybuilding passion. And once I was a grad student, I got really involved in research. And we started, the group that I'm with, we started working on specific publications that, now have been published. And I've been working on research since 2016, so the past 4.5 years or so. And that's been going great. So now I teach part-time at the university as an adjunct, and I research there. Basically that's basically what I do, and I coach full-time. So I have my feet in a lot of waters. I teach part-time, I research part-time, full-time, whatever you want to call it, and I coach full-time. And I'm still trying to be a better bodybuilder myself. So that's kind of the snapshot.
Sounds really, really good. I mean, having the foot in all waters is a great thing, even to bridge like the gap between the empirical and the anecdotal evidence, so to speak. And I think you're pretty big on this topic. You're seeing a lot of misconceptions in the evidence-based field right now. So could you maybe like outline a little bit how should evidence-based practice kind of look like?
Yeah, for sure. I'll kind of share my how my perspective has drastically changed from going into grad school and really thinking I was extremely evidence-based to getting involved with research and essentially changing how much the scientific research, how much do I truly actually value it, and how am I able to decipher what's a really good study that actually has solid practical application? What should you kind of proceed to intake with caution and not really jump on that bandwagon super quick? So when I was first getting into grad school, I used to see, someone else in the bodybuilding space that was an evidence-based coach or that had some research experience, and they would share a study. And like whatever that study said, whatever that conclusion was, I thought it was a black and white, this form or this methodology is better than this approach. So for example, like back then, HIIT cardio, everyone was saying that HIIT cardio was better than low intensity steady state. And, the top people in the industry were saying that. They were citing, one or two studies that had recently come out, and everyone would kind of hop on that bandwagon. And that would happen with so many different topics. And then over time, now a lot of people have moved away from HIIT, and they basically say it doesn't make a difference as long as you're burning the same amount of calories. And now they're even starting to avoid it because they think it's too centrally demanding and it increases so much systemic fatigue that it's going to decrease your lifting performance, yada, yada, yada. So long story short, I used to value like whatever someone else in the industry was putting out that was evidence-based, that was in the research field. I'm like, oh, what this person's saying has to be right. They're one of the brightest minds in the game, and this study is validating their statement. Once I got involved in research, And my mentor, Dr. Eduardo de Souza, he really taught me how to critically analyze a research study, and it totally changed everything. So it might sound crazy, but I used to value research even more than I currently do now. Mm-hmm. Even though I have a much better understanding of it. So it's interesting, to say the least. Yeah.
Absolutely. And a topic which is heavily discussed right now is kind of a set progression within a mesocycle. Mainly, there's a debate between Dr. Eric Helms and Dr. Mike Isotel, and that's basically a topic where we don't have like a bunch of studies which all point in the same direction. It's a thing where everyone has maybe their own opinion, their own experience. So what my question would be is, what your opinion is on in that regard. Do you program a set increase throughout a mesocycle, or do you keep sets rather constant? But your opinion on that topic overall?
Sure. So my intake on that definitely leans closer to the side of what Dr. Eric Helms is putting out. One thing that's important to understand about the research is we truly don't understand periodization for hypertrophy from, randomized control trials, because all of our studies are typically 8 to 12 weeks long, and we consider that a chronic study. If we get anything longer than 12 weeks, which we do from time to time, that's extremely rare. And sometimes those studies that are even longer, that are kind of investigating changes in strength or hypertrophy, they might not even be periodizing throughout different mesocycles of that research study. So we can't even take those longer studies and try to apply it to our training blocks, because they're not manipulating their volume throughout. So it kind of depends on the study. Nonetheless, when it comes to hypertrophy, I don't think it's necessary to increase your sets throughout the block. I understand the rationale behind it. Theoretically, it makes sense. I think that's important, right? Like, at least you have some theoretical construct as to why you think that this is optimal. But to say that it is or it isn't, we truly don't know that. What I personally do, I'm a huge fan of autoregulation. So on most of my exercises right now, I do about 2 working sets. I usually do a top set for a lower end of the rep range. So let's just say I'm doing incline bench press for 6 to 8 reps. Mm-hmm. I do as many warm up sets as I need to get to that first hardest working set of a heaviest weight for 6 reps. And then I do 1 back off set for the other end of the rep range, the higher end of the rep range, 8 reps, and I'm done. So I do 2 hard sets for that actual exercise and I'm done. I might have done 5 or 6 total, just because warm ups, 135 for a couple and then whatever. Yeah. That's how I approach a lot of exercises. Now, throughout a training block, on like my week 1, let's say it's a primer week or an intro week, however you want to term it, I might only do 1 working set and it might be at a lower RPE. And then I might do a back off set at a much lower RPE, not at like 9 or 10, but maybe at like 7 or 8. So my intro week is just going to be less intense and a little bit less volume. And then there's some days where I feel really good in the gym, and instead of doing 1 top set, 1 back off set, I do 1 top set and I do 2 back off sets. So now I did 3 working sets. Mm-hmm. So theoretically speaking, that would be increasing my working sets. It just wasn't necessary. It wasn't necessarily planned on paper going into the session. And it was something that, like, as silly as it may seem, it's like, I feel like I needed it. I feel like I could do it, and I feel like I would benefit by doing it. So I throw in an additional working set. There is a general construct of like increasing volume and intensity throughout the block. And then once I start getting tired, I might throw in a deload. But it's not super specific where it's adding sets, because that's a ton of extra volume that you're actually increasing to your weekly capacity or that one single training session. So it depends, man.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Mike is also pretty big on the autoregulation part. I mean, he's not saying just add 2 sets per muscle group each week. nonetheless, it's always based on a certain factors. Are you getting sore? Are you performing well? Are you, quote unquote, recovering physically and mentally? And yeah, if that's the case, I mean, a set increase might be valid in that situation. Maybe especially in regards to the latter part of the mesocycle, when the deload is pretty close, a topic which is really interesting in my opinion. So like the functional overreaching. So maybe pushing sets in the last week of your accumulation phase before the deload might have some potential benefits, especially for rather advanced individuals. But what I also stated in the conversation with Dr. Eric Helms I had a week ago was that like the state of functional overreaching was like really hard to identify. And he also said that, yeah, it requires you to guess to a certain extent, because recovery right now is defined as the return to baseline performance. So you're only really per definition overreached when your performance is dropping on most of your exercises. And yeah, that's like a really tough spot to be in. I mean, it doesn't happen to me really often, neither for my clients. So telling I'm functional overreaching right now, yeah, it's basically up to guess, right?
Yeah, for sure. For sure. The cool thing is, man, like so many of us in the exercise science space, we're searching for optimal, and no one knows what optimal is. So some people want to claim that their approach is better and their approach is optimal. The approach that I take is like damn near anything works. Like we just did a volume study that was published earlier this year, and we had subjects do either 12 sets per week, 18 sets per week, or 24 sets per week for leg training. And if you look at the group means, every single group grew, whether they did 12, 18, or 24 sets for that muscle group. Now, if you look at the individual differences, there are a lot of other things to take away from there. How many sets per week were they doing before they started the study? So what was their pre-baseline? What intensity were they training at before starting the study? Because what happens is when subjects come into the lab, they get pushed to a different level of intensity that they admit that they've never trained at before. So let's just say a subject came in and said, oh yeah, I typically do 18 sets per week for legs. And we put them in the 12 set per week group, right? Because we distributed the subjects based on their starting volumes, and we split them up into three different groups. So let's just say someone that was doing 18 sets is now doing 12 for our study. They're doing six less sets per week. A lot of people would say, oh, they're probably just maintained. They're not really going to make gains. But if the subject made tremendous gains, what was that reasoning for it? You know, my thought process, or from what I observe, I think a really important key is the training intensity that they're getting pushed at for these studies compared to kind of going into the gym and going through the motions. So, yeah, man, like we know there are so many different ways to approach it. There are so many ways that work. So it's really important for the listeners to find something that they enjoy, that motivates them to progress, that enables them to progress, and something that's sustainable. For me, I've been training like seriously for 11 years now. So I've experimented with a lot of things. I've had phases where like whatever was on my spreadsheet for that day, I would just get into a mindset to try to do whatever it takes to make those numbers happen. Some days you fail, some days you achieve those numbers and it feels good. And I think it's important to challenge yourself in that aspect. It's like, you're just going to get the job done. This is what you're set out to do. But that was a younger version of me. And, you know, there's been incidences where I sprained my SI joint and I really hurt my back, probably because I was under recovered and I really shouldn't have gone for those numbers. And now, being older, I still try to get after it every session. But if I'm not feeling great, I have no problem now taking an extra rest day. Like before, man, if I trained 5 days per week and I trained Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and I rested Wednesday and Sunday, if that schedule got ruined, if my rest day got thrown off, I was pissed. I was like, like legitimately like in a bad mood because like the day I was supposed to train this muscle group did not align like my planned schedule. I would be pissed off. Now I'm like, okay, I'm feeling under recovered. I got shitty sleep. I'm not training today. I'm going to go for a walk. I'm going to get outdoors, get some sunlight, do some active recovery, but I don't want to train today. And that wasn't the mindset that younger me had. And I think that's, pretty apparent just depending on like the age of the trainee.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think throughout your training career, you mature, so to speak, and you get way more, in contact with your own sensations as an athlete. And yeah, you're just starting to make the better calls for long-term gains. And yeah, that's what I'm experiencing with myself as well. But yeah, sometimes details or focusing on the details is also really important in order to make further adaptations or just to get the best out of training out of the training process. And one topic I heard you talk about on the it was the Muscle Memoirs podcast. Yeah, big shout out to these two guys. They do a really good job. I heard you talking about the sequencing of exercises there, and I thought that was a really interesting topic. And what one might think is, hey, if you want to prioritize a certain muscle group or an exercise, do it first in the session. Is that what it's basically coming down to, or are there any other factors which needs to be considered in that case?
Yeah, for sure, man. So in that regard, I think I have a couple of different thought processes than some others in the industry, or just something that's not really talked about or really thought about too much. When it comes to exercise selection, so if we're just talking about hypertrophy, right?
Sure, yeah.
I think it's really important that your sequence is way more logical than just kind of saying, I'm going to hit all of these movements within a session. I think it needs to make sense that they're sequenced in a specific order. So like, for example, I'll use the chest for right now.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people, the priority principle needs to stay true. So let's just say you want to focus on your clavicular head. You want to bring up that upper chest. You're probably going to put some sort of incline press first, right? And the reason for that is like, if you did a flat or a decline exercise early on, your front delts and your triceps are going to start to accumulate some fatigue. Your other chest fibers are going to accumulate some fatigue. So by the time you get to the exercise you're really trying to improve upon the most to target a specific region, you're not going to be able to move the same loads and create the same amount of tension. So for that reason, you know, the order of your exercise is really important. But something I generally speak about is not doing exercises that overload the lengthened portion of the range to a significant degree, and not doing exercises that create a lot of muscle damage early on in the training session. So if we were to do chest, that would be like doing a dumbbell fly. If I did dumbbell flies as my first exercise, it creates a lot of muscle damage because it's a very eccentric dominant movement. Obviously, the movement's hardest in the fully lengthened position. So if I were to do that and then go into a press, my pressing performance would really take a negative hit.
Sure.
Now, if I were to do the pec deck fly instead of the dumbbell fly, I wouldn't have as negative of a drawback from that, because it's the same amount of tension through the concentric and eccentric. Obviously, you can still work through a pretty large range of motion depending on how you set that up. But from what I've noticed is I can do that exercise as sort of like a primer, get into my presses and still perform really well. A more common muscle group where this is misapplied is probably the hamstrings. So a lot of people love the RDL and they might use that as their like primary hamstring movement. But my suggestion is, if you're training hamstring curls and a hip hinging movement or an RDL in the same session, always do your hamstring curl first.
Okay.
Because what I've noticed is if I do RDLs and again, that exercise creates a lot of muscle damage, is primarily eccentrically loading. By the time I get to my hamstring curls, my performance on them significantly drops.
Yeah.
Whereas if I do my hamstring curls first, I can still move, you know, maximum amounts of weight and then get into my RDLs and basically still move very similar loads to if I did the RDL first.
Interesting.
So your total volume session is going to be much higher if you sequence your exercise in a smart fashion.
Uh-huh.
Yeah,
that's what I'm experiencing by myself. I mean, I always did the RDL first, and when I get to the leg curls, they feel like kind of shit. But when I just do quad movements first and then go to the leg curl, man, they feel completely different. And yeah, I might gonna try what you just recommended in my own training, and gonna report back if that's working. Great.
Yeah, for sure, man. Like, look at your logbook, right? So look at the loads you moved on the hamstring curl when you performed it after the RDL. And then obviously look at how much weight you're using for the RDL, and then perform your hamstring curls first.
Mm-hmm.
Look at how much volume you do for that, and then do your RDL second or later on in the session. And your RDL, maybe it might go down a little bit, but not nearly as much as the hamstring curl did.
Yeah.
You know? So absolutely, you'll produce more total volume throughout that session.
Yeah. I think what you need to consider regarding the sequencing of exercises is that there's the local fatigue and, of course, the systemic fatigue. And obviously an RDL creates much more systemic fatigue as well in comparison to a leg curl. So if you're performing the RDL before the leg curl, that will influence the performance on the leg curl much more than the other way around, basically just because of that systemic fatigue as well. I mean, that's just on top of what you already said. So
And something else I want to point out too is, like, not all leg curls are created equal. So when you're doing a lying leg curl and your hips are in a more extended position, you're able to get your hamstring fully shortened.
Mm-hmm.
So you can flex at the knee and you can extend at the hip and get your hamstring fully shortened. So even when you're performing that eccentric to the lying leg curl, when your hamstring is in its fully lengthened position in that particular exercise, it's still nowhere near its fully lengthened position, right? Now, if you were to do a seated hamstring curl, your hips are flexed.
Yeah.
So at the top of the seated hamstring curl, you can create more muscle damage because you're actually having that hamstring at a longer muscle length.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Right? So it's like, it's not the same. So, and then obviously when you do the RDL, you're getting a full stretch and you're creating as much damage or length as possible. So it's interesting because if you were to do the seated hamstring curl, you would feel a different sensation than you do when you do the lying hamstring curl.
Yeah. I mean, that's due to the, how is it called? Active insufficiency, that a muscle cannot contract on both ends, right?
So yeah, it has to do with active insufficiency, and also just the fact that when you're doing the lying hamstring curl, the myosin and actin filaments are getting more overlap.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, this might sound silly to some, but when I'm doing seated hamstring curls, I feel it more in my distal hamstring region. So I can say from, like, the mid hamstring belly to behind the knee, right? And then when I'm doing lying hamstring curls, I feel it more from the bottom of my glutes, right, to the middle of my femur. So I get, like, a deeper sensation at the proximal portion of the hamstring when I'm doing lying curls compared to the seated curl. And, you know, a lot of people debate about the whole regional hypertrophy thing, and that's something we're still researching, but it's actually something that I'm an advocate for, whatever you want to call it, but it's something that I want to investigate further down the road.
Yeah. Absolutely. So, right now, is there a recommendation you want to give out regarding leg curls? If you're doing them twice a week, should one, like, be in a lying position, one in a seated, or are you?
For sure, I can make some recommendations. So if you are training, you know, hamstrings twice a week, you can definitely consider having one curl variation be in a extended hip position. So that can be a standing curl, depending on the gym you have, even the kneeling plate loaded hamstring curl, that's still a hip extended position, or a lying curl. And then the other one can be a seated curl. Okay. You know what I'm saying? And then same thing, if you're doing hip hinging movements twice per week, one day could be the RDL, and then the next day it can be like a 45 degree hip extension. Yep. Where it's totally different, right? And then for the RDL, it's the opposite strength curve. So for the RDL, it's the hardest at the bottom when the hamstrings are fully lengthened. And then when you come to the top of an RDL, you can hold the barbell there for days, and it's not, there's no tension on your hamstrings or your glutes, you know? So yeah, like you can alter your hip hinging pattern as well if you're hitting things twice per week.
Yeah. Cool. Another thought is, if you're approaching an upper body day and you're training a chest and back, how would you sequence that? I mean, you have the opportunity to start with chest and do a back exercise, then do another chest exercise followed by another back exercise. But then you could also do chest, back. I mean, that's kind of interesting because the first option maybe gives you overall maybe more mechanical tension, more tonnage, because you're removing some of the local fatigue in between those sets, but the second option maybe gives you earlier fiber recruitment, and by that maybe a better stimulus to fatigue ratio, maybe better pumps and more metabolite aggregation. So yeah. What do you think about that?
Yeah, man, it totally depends on your goal. So in the past, I used to have a full upper body days. I've done that a lot. I would do a full upper day, a full lower day, and then I might do like a push-pull legs. Like that might be a five-day split that I've been on. And on those upper days, it was typically more strength focused, or just the goal was to move heavier loads. So I would generally do like a push exercise, fully rest, then do a pull exercise, push, pull, and flip flop between them for, you know, lower rep ranges with the goal of just pounding as much tonnage as possible. Mm-hmm. Recently my split is different. I actually do have a chest and back day throughout my microcycle, but it's more on metabolic conditioning, so to speak, and accumulating as many metabolites as possible and getting a really big pump. So right now I'm pairing that as an agonist-antagonist superset. Mm-hmm. So just like a really simple example would be doing like a flat dumbbell press and a bent over dumbbell row. And you're just pulling and pushing in the same plane. Or it can be like a hammer strength incline press, where I'm essentially pushing through this plane and then I'm doing a lat pull down or a high row in the same exact plane, just push, pull, push, pull. Mm-hmm. And right now I'm doing that for higher reps with lighter load, with the goal really to create as much of a pump as possible. So I think it's important that you just ask yourself, what's the goal of the training session? And both approaches are absolutely acceptable. They both work. It just really comes down to what you want to do. If time efficiency is an issue, or you don't have a lot of time to spend in the gym, doing the antagonist agonist supersets is a great way to save time, where it shouldn't negatively impact your performance that much. Mm-hmm. You know, is it going to be the same as fully resting? No, but there's actually some data. I forget the authors of the study in particular, but they actually found that total volume load increased when they paired agonist antagonist supersets for chest and back. So there might be a benefit to it, and you're saving time. Mm-hmm. So yeah, definitely can't hurt.
Cool. Thanks. Let's move on to another topic, which is also, not like set in stone. It's muscle fiber specific hypertrophy. We have those slow twitch muscle fibers, which are more enduring, kind of more resistant to fatigue. They regenerate rather quickly. And then there are those fast twitch fibers, which can perform rather strong contractions, are getting tired quickly, regenerate more slowly, but they're having a higher growth potential, and then there are some fibers in between, some intermediate fibers, but I don't think we need to mention them. And then there's the Henneman size principle, of course, which states that small motor units, so these slow twitch fibers, are recruited with just lower power requirements, and when maximum efforts are required, the larger and stronger motor units of the fast twitch type turn on and produce the force. And of course, how the fiber types are distributed is different from person to person, and also from muscle to muscle. Mm-hmm. And how relevant is fiber specific hypertrophy in your opinion, and what implications could this have for our programming? And is there even a practical benefit in knowing your fiber type distribution within a certain muscle group?
Yeah, no, that's a great question, man, and a very interesting topic. I would say I don't think we have all the answers at this point, but something that I personally got away from for quite a while was doing like anything over 15 reps. That was probably for a couple of years, man. I wasn't doing anything over 15s. And I think it negatively impacted my ability to progress, because I do think I am kind of slow twitch dominant, if you want to say that. Strength sport has never been like my forte by any means. And I think a lot of that also comes down to bone structure and skeletal frame, not just fiber type in regards to your strength. That's kind of a whole other topic. Maybe we'll talk about that in a minute. But I think it's really important from a programming aspect that people don't shy away from doing things above 15 reps or utilizing some sort of advanced techniques like a drop set, where you're doing like a set of 12 or 15 and then dropping it and then doing another 5 and then dropping it and doing another however many. So they're doing 25 plus reps in a set. For me personally, I think I'm more slow twitch dominant. So when I have had that rep scheme in my training program, I feel like I've made more progress utilizing it than avoiding it. And then if I'm someone, if I'm going through a block where I'm personally just really focused on lower rep ranges, let's call it anywhere from 3 to 8. I might get stronger from a neurological standpoint, but I don't feel like I get much bigger. Mm-hmm. And even though the fast twitch fibers do have much greater growth potential, if genetically you're more slow twitch dominant, training in that rep range might not be as beneficial for you. So I think it's important that individuals experiment with different training types and are pretty meticulous with tracking like how their physique is changing during those times, so they assess what might be better for them.
Yeah, I think that's really tough, because you always have to dedicate a certain time frame to a specific endeavor. And I'm usually like changing things like rather step by step than completely changing all the rep ranges. So it's always like kind of hard to extrapolate what's like the reason for maybe the muscle growth. So yeah, what would be maybe another way of how to identify whether you are rather slow twitch or fast twitch within a certain muscle group? Is there maybe something else apart from which rep range is giving you like the best muscle growth? Because I mean, that's like really hard to tell, in my opinion.
Sure. So I'll tell you why I think I'm more slow twitch dominant. Mm-hmm. It's because there's a few reasons. So A, even when I'm fresh it could be the first rep of a set, my power is, so my bar velocity, how quickly I can move the bar, is never super impressive. Mm-hmm. Even if it's like my first rep on a set of 8, right? So that first rep, you have no fatigue yet. You should be able to move the bar with pretty significant force and at a higher bar velocity.
Yep.
for me personally, I can't, it just, my power is not impressive. My force development's not impressive. Mm-hmm. More importantly than that is if I, you know, let's say we fail for a set of six or a set of eight, you basically just know, like, once you complete that rep, okay, there's no way I'm going to get another rep. The bar was moving so slow. I'm not going to be able to crank out another rep. Now, when I do stuff in like that 15 to 20 rep range, my 10th rep might look super slow and I'm still able to squeeze out another 10 reps. It's just like a really slow concentric. It's like painfully slow. And it's not a powerful contraction, but I'm just able to grind those out. And it seems like those are my endurance fibers that are just able to kind of regenerate and continue to fire throughout the set.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I think the way that some people truly fail on a set, can give you some insight in regards to whether they're more endurance based or whether they're more power based, if that makes sense.
That makes total sense. And, another point you mentioned again in the Muscle Memoirs podcast was that, you just need to consider your, rep maxes, so to speak, within a certain rep range, and which performance is like the most impressive might give you a hint where you're you're at regarding your muscle fiber distribution, maybe.
So I'll use that example for the listeners here. It's like, let's just say your 10 RM and your 5 RM aren't that much different, or your 10 RM and even your 1 RM isn't that much different, then it's like you're probably more on that endurance side, right? So it's interesting. In one of our studies, we had our subjects come in and they tested their 1 RM on back squat, right? So we did two assessments. We did a maximal strength assessment, which was their 1 RM, and we also did a strength endurance assessment, which was an AMRAP, as many reps as possible, with 70% of their 1 RM.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you look at a textbook, you might say, like, you might see a specific repetition goal that you should be able to perform with 70%, right? The funniest thing is seeing the intra-individual variability where, you know, somebody might have, let's just call it a, let me do some numbers. Let's say their squat is 405 1 RM, right? So we need them to do 283 pounds for an AMRAP.
Yeah.
Some people might only be able to squeeze out like 7 reps, even though it's way less weight than their 1 RM. And then someone else might be able to squeeze out like 25 reps.
Yeah, that's crazy.
But when you look for a textbook answer, it'll be like, yeah, you can do like 12 reps with it, whatever it means. So it's really interesting to see how everyone's totally different in that realm. And I think that's a pretty good indicator in regards to what fiber type or what kind of training might be best for you, what's kind of most natural for you.
Absolutely. And is there any evidence that we can maybe change the fiber type distribution through maybe a specific training?
There is evidence on fiber type transitioning and training, but I'm truly not an expert on that topic. It's just not, that's not my particular wheelhouse. So I wouldn't want to say something incorrect, to be totally honest.
Sure.
But yeah, there's definitely evidence. I mean, one thing I will say is, for example, if you actually stop training completely, you'll actually get some fiber turnover, like fiber transition from slow twitch to fast twitch, and you're not training at all.
Okay.
So it doesn't always have to make sense.
Uh-huh.
Basically put it that way. And it can be very weird and maybe even unlogical. So I don't think we need to spend a lot of time understanding that transitioning phase personally, but again, not my expertise.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, if you really want to find out what fiber type you are, you need to get a biopsy, basically.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, that would be the only way to really tell, but in the end, I don't think that there's a really a practical benefit in knowing whether you are rather fast or slow twitch. I mean, getting sets close to failure within a certain rep range of maybe 5 to 20 reps for the most part will just seal the deal, right?
Yeah. Yeah, man, for the most part. Right now, I'm literally training in the 6 to 20 rep range, and then sometimes I even do like an extended intensity technique or a drop set. So, yeah, that's the way I'm separating my training right now. I'm focusing on those rep ranges, and I'm splitting it up each training session. So I used to kind of start off with a primer, do a very heavy movement for that 6 to 8 rep range, and then towards the end of the session, finish off with like metabolic work and higher rep ranges and pump work. At this very moment, I'm getting away from that approach, and I'm having more just like strength focused days where I'm in that. Well, for me, it's 6 to 8. That's not considered strength for a lot of people, but to me, it's considered strength.
For hypertrophy.
Yeah, more focused on mechanical tension. Then I have other days where I'm more in that typical 8 to 12 zone. And then I have other days where I'm doing 20s, 15s, and 12s and drop sets and stuff. So I'm changing up my training, working on a new program, and I have a couple of clients experimenting with me. So it's been fun so far. We'll see where it goes.
Nice. Chris, do we have time for one more question?
Absolutely. Yeah, we got 10 minutes. Yes,
okay,
sir.
Yeah, that's cool. So you mentioned intensity techniques. I get asked by clients a lot whether I would recommend programming these, and what I think they are for the most part is just time efficiency. I mean, what you're basically doing is you're modulating the rest times between sets. That's what a rest pause or a myoreps are essentially. You're just cutting the rest times. Do you see any unique benefit in doing like intensity techniques regarding the hypertrophy stimulus? Is there any magic about those?
I do think there are some benefit there, man, for sure. Again, I think we need a little bit more research on it specifically, but essentially what's cool is, like, let's just use a drop set, for example, right? So let's say you failed on a set of 8 repetitions. You know that you couldn't squeeze out that 9th rep, but it doesn't mean that the muscle is totally shot. It just, you couldn't move that load that you were working with. So if you drop the load by 30% or even as much as 50% or even as little as 20%, whatever, you're going to be able to squeeze out more reps, and you're still challenging that muscle at such a high level where basically all motor units are on board because you already reached that failure point, and you're basically forcing that muscle to continue to contract at its highest threshold for a longer period of time. So not only are you increasing time under tension, you're kind of increasing time under tension of the effective reps. So I do think that there are smart ways to program that in. I just think it's important that you pay attention to your recovery. What phase are you in of your training? You know, are you a novice, intermediate, or advanced? And how do you want to, like, systemically program those in a very smart way? So I personally love drop sets. I love intraset stretching, just to create the nastiest pump. I used to utilize more blood flow restriction training. I haven't done that in a minute, but I think it's a great tool depending on your split, your setup, what your weak points are. There's a lot of ways that you can use BFR to kind of benefit your physique without hurting your recovery. It can actually improve your recovery. I even pair like a lot of agonist, antagonist, superset, stuff like that. So I think there's a lot of techniques that are beneficial. If there's any one in particular you want me to discuss, I would love to go down there too.
Yeah. I mean, we're pretty close on time. Maybe, in our next discussion, we'll, touch on, the certain techniques, but sure. I think, you mentioned some really good points. I mean, you can really use that local fatigue to, yeah, let your motor units turn on faster, and that maybe gives you a better stimulus to fatigue ratio per rep, so you don't have to grind through those lead-in reps throughout your set, where most of your slow twitch fibers are active, and straight like to the point where like the fast motor units are turning on, which have the highest growth potential, so that might not be a bad idea. Really cool. Chris, thank you so much for the great conversation. Really enjoyed it. At the end, I of course want you to give, well, I want you to plug your stuff. So sure. Is there any side where people can check you out?
Yeah, for sure. So for most of the educational content and resources, articles, research, and videos, check out schoolofgains.com. Gains is spelled with a Z. On there, you'll find, like I said, blog articles. All of my published research is on there, educational videos, and then obviously programs that I sell. So I have different training programs, a nutrition guide, as well as coaching services with my team and I. So you can see all of that there. If you're a competitive bodybuilder, you can check out competitivebreed.com. So you can kind of see the athlete team of mine and what we've been doing over the last 5 years now. And then on Instagram, I'm most active. That's like my only social media platform that I really use a lot. And that's just my full name. It's at Christopher.Barricat.
Great. I'm going to link, all the stuff you mentioned in the show notes. And just one more thing. At the end of each episode, we put a track on our Spotify playlist. We have a playlist called Hypertrophy Cast Playlist on Spotify. And every guest and myself, we put a song on there, something which you enjoy maybe while training. Do you have any song for us?
Oh, that's super cool. Let me see. I'm gonna pull out my phone real quick.
Sure.
That's a really cool approach that you're doing. I like that.
Kind of into music, so curious to see what other people are listening to. So,
okay. So I'm a New Yorker. I'm from New York. So I'm a big, I'm a big Fabulous fan.
Yeah.
Let's do Cold Summer by Fabulous.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Cold Summer. And I'm going to take, Ma Baker from Bonnie M.
Okay.
Not sure if you know that. It's an old song, but it gives me the chills. So
nice.
Nice. Thanks, Chris, again. Have a great day. Thanks everyone for listening, and see you next Sunday. Bye bye.
Thanks, Lewis.